Yeah, baby. Motown Monday. It's The Drive on ESPN Sports Radio 1392.5. No Jimmy this week.
It's off getting married.
I know, but it's what an excuse to take a week off from work, getting married.
In the middle of the busiest time of the sports
whatever.
Year.
Whatever. Just stay away, Jimmy. Sean and I are here, and we are now joined by one of our absolute favorite people, and what a great time to speak with him, the great Kurt Becker.
Yeah, he's my traveling buddy. He calls horse racing, he calls NASCAR, he's an Eclipse Award-winning broadcaster and cottage cheese enthusiast. Kurt Becker. Welcome to the show, Kurt.
I didn't know that whole thing about Hi, Kurt. Really? Cottage cheese?
Absolutely. First, it's good to be back with you once again. And yes, from the time I was a mere child, probably maybe around 8 or 9 years old, was my first experience with cottage cheese, and I've never gotten over it. I always keep I have to keep two containers at my house because there's one. I am so obsessed with it. There's one container I will grab when I'm hungry for a snack and literally eat out of the container. So I have to keep an uncontaminated container, if you will, for when guests come to the house.
Your company cottage cheese.
Right.
Your company cottage cheese.
We have to pick our hotels when we go on the road based upon who has cottage cheese on the room service.
Oh, my Lord. Okay. This is number one on my list of things I never thought I would hear on this show. That's number one right there.
Things get weird when we have Kurt Becker on.
Oh, yeah. But we like it that way. All right. Kurt, we're sitting here trying to come up with the correct term for this big race that's happening on Saturday. And when Sean said it before, he said the Belmont, I said, oh, cool, the last leg of the jewels of the triple. What do we call it? What do we do?
I think the trainer Todd Pletcher, who will send out a couple of starters for the race this Saturday, Todd was asked about this. Typically, it's the final of the three races in the Triple Crown. This year, it's the first. Typically, it's run at a mile and a half. This year, it's being run at a mile and an eighth. The way Todd put it is, he said, look, because of COVID-19 and the way it has affected seemingly every aspect of life, 2020 as a year will have an asterisk next to it. And Todd said that's going to be the same for this year's Belmont and this year's Triple Crown Series. And I think maybe that's as close as I've heard anyone come to summarizing the Belmont and the whole Triple Crown Series this year.
Well, my thought, I think I said this to Sean a little while ago, a week or two ago, when they announced the Triple Crown schedule and that the Belmont not only was going to be the first race, but that the distance had been changed. Can we truly call this the Triple Crown even this year? Because the changes that have been made are dramatically affecting what's going to happen in all three of these races, right?
It will. It changes the whole dynamic. And I am in the camp that says perhaps the number one factor that has changed is you go from a situation of a three-year-old having to win three marathon races, what we in the U.S. would consider marathon races, in the span of 5 weeks.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not even arguably all marathon distances, and the goal is to win three races in a little over the span of 3 months. There is simply no way in the traditional understanding of the Triple Crown that if a horse wins all three races this year, there's simply no way that one can rank that, especially because of the time constraint, weeks versus months. It is not the same thing. That's not to detract from the achievement. It's still remarkable. Those mm-hmm. are still three races that are going to draw the best three-year-olds, presumably, in North America. And it will be a big deal for the horse, the connections. It'll have implications, certainly, for stallion fees and such. So I'm not denying any of that. We're thrilled at Horse Racing Radio to be covering all three events. But I think it is disingenuous to suggest that, oh, no, you know, if a horse wins all three, it's the same triple crown as we've always known it. It, in an objective sense, based on fact, it simply is not the case.
Right. And Sean, hold on one second. What occurs to me also is the whole notion of, and I still always have trouble with this, that all three-year-olds are supposedly born on January 1st, right? Even though
that's,
we know that's not the case.
That's their listed birthday, yeah.
Okay. But right. The Kentucky Derby, which is obviously the first weekend in May, traditionally, now the Belmont is the first one, but it's later. So a horse that might have, say, developed fast enough to win the Kentucky Derby in a normal year, now with the Belmont coming later, there are horses that might have, just in the last month, might have developed at a different pace. So again, we really have no idea about how this is going to play out.
That's true, and I think it also, in that regard, has implications regarding, you mentioned the foaling date, absolutely. You get horses that were foaled in May, and particularly when you look down the road to the Derby on September 5th this year, if I've got a horse who's a late foal and he's got that much more time to mature and round into form before the Derby gets here, I would be thrilled about that aspect. And I think it also will have interesting implications for training regimens. I'll give you an example. You look at all the success that Bob Baffert has had in the Triple Crown, and I realize Bob has had an unusual year for him. He's
yeah.
had a number of his hopefuls already sidelined, so I understand that. But just using him as an example, here's a guy whose training regimen is very strict, very disciplined, very tough, and very much geared toward the spring. And if you look back over the years, does Bob still have success later in the season? Yes, he does, but arguably maybe not at the same rate he does in the springtime, and I think it has a lot to do with his general program. And if you look at other trainers, you look at a Bill Mott, for example, who has generally steered clear, with exceptions, most notably a Country House, for example, but Bill has usually steered clear of trying to hone and prepare a horse for races in May and June. Well, you look at Bill, and for a trainer from his school of thought, patience, 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 I think this schedule lines up arguably more for trainers with that kind of program. Now, I say that, watch Bob come out of the class.
Yeah.
Through all three races, so yep. You just never know.
So the Belmont, this is the first time the Belmont's been the first race run. Am I correct in that?
I believe that is right, because I know both the Preakness and the Derby at one time or another have, obviously Derby, but the Preakness on occasion going back decades ago would be the kickoff race. I am not immediately aware of a situation where the Belmont's ever been the first of the three.
I don't remember just looking every day. I looked to see what happened on this day, and I don't remember seeing the Belmont anytime in May. So going on the assumption that this is the first leg of the Triple Crown technically this year, they're only expecting 10 horses. Do you have any theory as to why this field is going to be so small? Usually the Derby, the first run, is 20-horse field, 19, 20, depending. Why so few in the Belmont?
Well, that's a great question, Sean, and I think maybe a couple of factors are at play. I think it speaks to the magnitude and the stature of the Kentucky Derby, and maybe this is how some of the connections, the owners and trainers alike, are looking at this revamped Triple Crown this year. To me, the goal that everybody really wants is to own a Derby winner. Is it fun to say you've had a Belmont winner? Absolutely. Heck, I would love to be able to say I owned a racehorse who won the Belmont Stakes. No question about that. But I've also talked to owners, to trainers, and to jockeys who have told me if they are on a flight, for example, and someone next to them says, so what do you do? Well, I'm in the thoroughbred business. Oh, wow. First question mm-hmm. they get, have you ever won the Kentucky Derby?
Yeah.
They don't get the question, have you won the Breeders' Cup Classic? Have you won the Preakness? Have you won the Belmont? Those questions might follow in the discussion, but the first one is, have you won the Derby? So I think that perhaps that is one of the factors that's at play here. And the other thing maybe is, rightly or wrongly, it seems like Belmont Park over the years and the Belmont Stakes has gotten the reputation, maybe it's because of Big Sandy, the deep, tiring, sandy nature of that great big racetrack. There seems to be a perception that if you're not a Belmont-based horse, it's tough to win that race. Now, we can cite examples all day long of horses that were not based there that have won it. Yeah. We're just talking about Bob Baffert. I mean, he's a California-based guy, for example. But maybe to some degree that perception is at work, and maybe some of it is, guys, everybody's schedule has been so thrown off.
Yeah.
We are just now starting to get back into a nationwide system of racing. Even though we did have some tracks that raced throughout the lockdown, we are just now really starting to get back up to full song. I think maybe a lot of trainers are saying, man, I need time to clear my head and make sure I'm doing what's best for the horse.
Yeah.
Do you foresee a full field at the Kentucky Derby?
I hate it when I'm listening to a sports show and an analyst comes on who won't give a straight answer. So I'm gonna go ahead and go out on a limb here. I'm going to say yes, and I think again that speaks to what the race is, what it means to the connections of this sport, and the fact that I think this was a great move on Churchill Downs' part. When Churchill took more control over how the starting lineup is determined and a few years ago started the road to the Kentucky Derby, and they said, okay, look, enough. This is our race. We control it. We've got the right to determine how a horse gets in here. Well, in the process, they've built this whole storyline, and it'll be the same as the summer unfolds, even with a different schedule, of going to certain races, gaining the points, with the goal of just getting the spot in that gate. And I think that is still going to be paramount for anyone who's got a top level 3-year-old. I think we will end up with a full gate of 20.
All right, and one last question on horse racing before we move on. Are you going to be down here for the July meet, or are we going to let the prior track announcer back in the booth?
Well, and of course, for those listening, if you're not aware, Keeneland raced for 60 years without a track announcer, and Sean, you've touched on something. This is no kidding. That was one of my concerns from a selfish standpoint. I thought, oh man, are they just going to say, hey, look, at this point, it's just best to go with the track announcer? I will be the first to admit, I think you're good to be honest with your own situation. I am non-essential. So I will say I am grateful to the industry and to Keeneland. They have given me the invitation to come down and call. So as it stands, I'm scheduled to be there to call the race.
Great.
Good deal.
That's great.
Has that booth got air conditioning? Because you've never worked down here in the middle of the summer.
I'll put it this way. The October race meet, at least for the opening weekend, it can get pretty warm, and the air conditioning struggles to keep up. So if it has that kind of problem in October, I might want to at least bring a couple of electric fans or something to put in the booth.
Ooh-wee. All right, let's switch over to the other sport that you are heavily involved in, NASCAR.
Yes.
It has been it's been a very busy few weeks, but this past week has been one of the most fascinating weeks I've ever seen in the sport. First off, Bubba Wallace runs the Black Lives Matter car at Martinsville and has previously, it goes on CNN leading up to that event, calling on NASCAR to ban the display of the Confederate flag or even the possession of the Confederate flag at NASCAR tracks. The next day, NASCAR comes out and does just what he asked. I don't think he's the only one that was asking, but he kind of came to the forefront of it. I don't really even know what I'm trying to ask here. What are your thoughts on what's happened this past week with regards to Black Lives Matter and the flag, and then the blue line car yesterday, I think, that ran at Homestead?
I think that one of the first things that came to my mind, I remember when I was probably a freshman or maybe sophomore in college, the Texas versus Johnson case that went to the Supreme Court regarding the right to burn the American flag as a means of political expression. And William Brennan, and the reason I'm bringing this up, I studied political science in college. I've always been fascinated with with I guess you would say politics as a branch of philosophy. And Brennan had an interesting point in his ruling. He had said regarding the desecration of the American flag, his point writing for the majority was when something is offensive to anyone, the answer is to engage in more speech, more discussion, a greater exchange of ideas. And I think that you've touched on some of that with the fact that historically speaking, first time we have had a car run in the Cup Series with something such as Black Lives Matter designated on the quarter panels. And it has generated a lot of discussion, and I think that part is good. Now, as far as the specific banning of the Confederate flag from NASCAR property, NASCAR is well within their rights to do what they want to do. My only concern is I genuinely hope, and this is not to sound Pollyanna, but I hope that there is a dialogue going forward between NASCAR fans on both sides of that issue. Because I think that from the fans that I have talked to over the years, just knowing what I do about the traditional fan base, I don't think they ever hoisted that flag and thought of it in the way that maybe in 2020 America we look at that flag and think of it. By the same token, I grew up in the Midwest, and I had a friend growing up who was a student of history, and I remember him telling me back when we were teenagers, he said his problem with that flag was that it was a symbol of an armed insurrection against the duly constituted government of the United States. So I think on the one side of the flag issue, the more people talk about this, if they can talk about it, and if we can articulate those types of arguments, if I am a traditional Southern NASCAR fan, and if I'm saying, look, if nothing else, listen to me, I never meant to fly that as a symbol of racism or an endorsement of slavery. Maybe listen to them and at least be respectful of the positive aspects of what they are trying to articulate about Southern heritage. By the same token, if you're someone who's saying, look, for me, because of my circumstance, because of my race, my creed, what have you, when I walked onto the property, that troubled me, that bothered me, I didn't really feel welcome here. Let's continue to have that discussion and hopefully reach an understanding. Because my only concern is, I'm a firm believer, no matter what issue it is, if you're passionate about an issue, the key is always to change hearts and minds. And that ultimately is what I would like to see going forward. Because if nothing else, there are folks of all creeds, colors, races, ethnicities that like motorsports and that like NASCAR. And sure, as someone who works in the sport, and as a fan of the sport, as someone who shares that love of the sport, I want to see as many people as we can get to the track to get there and have a good time and feel comfortable doing it.
Right.
Yeah. And my feelings on that, I'm sorry to interject my editorial here, but
no,
the rebel flag, the cross blue with the stars and the red background, that wasn't a country flag. That was a battle flag. And it didn't resurge in popularity until the 1920s, when Jim Crow started getting more and more prominent in the South, and when the Daughters of the Confederacy started erecting all these statues, the way that it's looked at now. And maybe the people that are flying it don't know this. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they don't. It is strictly, in my view, a way to show that you're other to an entire section of the, and that's, you know, that's my opinion. That's how I feel about it. And I don't want NASCAR to make anybody feel like they're other.
And to your point, Sean, I've asked myself this question. I live in central Illinois. I grew up in a family involved in standardbred racing, trotters and pacers. And it's interesting how a lot of times, too, the people will change their attitudes and so on. Frankly, when other factors are involved, I'm going to give you one I've witnessed here in Illinois, the economy. And let me tell you what I mean by that.
We have a couple minutes, Kurt.
Back about 20 years ago, there were stables from the deep south who began bringing harness horses to the fair circuit in Illinois. These were primarily African-American horsemen. Mm-hmm. And they began investing a lot of money in this state, in some cases moved to communities in central Illinois, began contributing to the local economy. And it was amazing to see, and that's not to sound crass, but it was amazing to see that where dollars and cents are involved, I think in that case people had at least stopped and said, how foolish is it to want to ban somebody because of skin color or race? And through economic input, that might not have been the ideal way to go at it. But yet, I'm glad to say that we have seen true diversity in all places in rural America, in central Illinois, in the harness racing game here in my home state. Mm. It's a different case with NASCAR, but then again, it isn't. As you touched on, and as I talked about earlier, if people are race fans and if they want to be at that track, I just want to see a day when they can come enjoy the race. And I don't care if the guy sitting next to me is white, black, brown, green, blue. Let's have fun. You cheer for your driver, I cheer for mine, and I'm optimistic we're going to get to that point.
There you go.
All right, and to close, I'll say two things. First, I graduated with a degree in political science also.
Me too.
And
nice.
If I hear one more time on this show a comment about, I've always thought of political science in terms of philosophy. seems like every day we hear that phrase. And we are going to have more cottage cheese than you could eat when you come to Lexington, and we better see you.
Yeah. Come in a day early. Come by the studio. Sit in with us.
That is fantastic. And guys, I'll tell you this much right now. I hope the management at Keeneland is not listening, because frankly, they could probably pay me in cottage cheese and I'd be a happy camper.
All right, well, I'm going to call G.D. Hieronymus and let them know over there what you just said. Okay, cool. You're the best. Thanks, Kurt. We'll see you.
Fellas, thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
Okay, right. You too. He's so wonderful.
Yeah.
All right, talking about wonderful, Chuck Culpepper when we get back. Nobody better.
Nah.
That's all I'll say. It's The Drive on ESPN Sports Radio 1392.5, brought to you by Dan Cummins in Paris and Georgetown.